from Vision Australia Radio. It's time to open the cellar door and uncork a classic on Heard It Through the Grapevine.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm Michael Hintz, the velvety voice of Vino, with another Heard It Through the Grapevine on Vision Australia Radio and coming to you nationally through the Community Radio Network. And that's hello from my producer, the ebullient Lloyd Shirley. Today it's my pleasure to talk to the erudite Josh Elias, editor-in-chief, not just editor, editor-in-chief and publisher of the stylish avant-garde drinks quarterly called Alchemy. Josh is going to update us as to, what's happening between the covers. That's the covers of the magazine I'm talking about, in the latest Alchemy Edition 5. Now, Josh last spoke to us just before Christmas, when Alchemy celebrated its first birthday. Josh, welcome back to Grapevine.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
That's all right. You haven't aged a bit. Now, before we delve into Edition 5, as my guest, it's your call as to this week's Wine of the Week, which I believe is a Journey Wines, and I think it's a 2013 vintage, Shiraz, good old Shiraz, the old Australian standby, Australia's Opera House, from Heathcote. Now, what made you choose a Heathcote Shiraz? And then when you've answered that, take us through the flavour profile of the wine, Josh.
Shiraz is one of my original guilty pleasures in the wine industry, and I think like many New World drinkers, we love the fruit and the opulence and the just dense viscosity of the palate when we drink it. And for me, you know, as working in a sommelier in the trade as my past and background, it's kind of this thing that people don't expect. I should be liking Riesling and thin, acidic, lean styles of low alcohol white wine is essentially the trend with my beard and that sort of thing. Yep. People expect me to be relatively hip. Heathcote Shiraz is one of my original loves. And Damien North has this lovely, it's around 14.5% alcohol Heathcote Shiraz. And Damien also used to work on the floor in restaurants. So I can see his dedication as a past, but he since went to Charles Sturt University, relocated to the Yarra Valley, and he's making wine there.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, he is. He's making it at Medhurst, which is where he makes the wines. Mm-hmm. But he sources the grapes from Heathcote for this particular Shiraz. Mm. It's dense, it's lovely, and it has this tension between full-bodied richness, but it still has eucalypt, black pepper, and lovely spice. And it's that kind of duality of the wine that gives you that alluring refreshingness as well.
Gee, he does it. Doesn't Josh do this well? I tell you what, you know what you're talking about. I just feel like a drink of it now.
Well, if you don't, we're making dinner. Pretend pretty well.
Thank you. I might just have a quick sip now. Mm. Oh, see what you mean. Yes, lovely. Ah, yes. Well, Heathcote's a great area, isn't it? Just full stop. There's a lot happening up there, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Now, for those who mightn't be familiar with Alchemy, Josh, please explain again, take us through what you're trying to achieve regarding your manifesto, so the key components, because I think it's important to set the context here. Firstly, you've got three or four key components. Firstly, perception goes far beyond desirable taste.
Sure. Well, the manifesto itself is something that we inserted into the publication to give a bit of context to the enjoyment of wine and all beverages, because, you know, we are talking about drinking an alcoholic beverage. Yep. And we wanted to sort of set the record straight just to show that it wasn't, you know, unstoppable excess. We wanted to make sure that it was about really cherishing the glass in context of a dining table with friends.
Yes.
And so we really set about just setting the tone with the manifesto. It's something we've kept in every edition, but it really sets the bar for how people should enjoy their wine, and also just have it in moderation as well, because I think that it is a tendency to sort of have non-stop excess, you know, when you're looking at pages of lovely, alluring beverages, but we want to sort of keep a little bit of moderation there, which is, this is more, absolutely. Mm.
Now, I like the thing about the context in which we drink is as important as what we drink, and that was well illustrated in this edition. We'll get to this in a moment by an article by Christian McCabe, the piece on context. That's the context is important too, isn't it?
Absolutely. Context is, for me, everything. I mean, as lovely it is to drink wine in a white room in a museum box without any conversation and no music, it is generally about the dining table and your friends. And certainly, you don't want a wine to impose on the circumstance. You want the circumstance to impose on the wine. Mm-hmm. And that really will allow your guests, you know, who may not have the depth of wine appreciation that you have, or may not have the nuanced understanding of what you're drinking or where it comes from, but they certainly want to enjoy your company and the conversation.
Mm, well put. And we'll skip the creation of drink and forms of our understanding of it, because I think you've just really covered that in what you said. Mm. But lastly, to understand the value of alcohol, we must firstly appreciate each other. Now, that's a bit interesting.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think that certainly if you understand your guest and you understand the dining table, that really helps to inform you as to what you're drinking. It might not be wine. It might be after vintage when all you've been doing is working with wine, and a beer would suit much better. So we do really look at the world of drinks holistically, because wine is part of a meal, but it's certainly not every day.
Yep. And by the way, whilst on alcohol, Australians appear to be drinking less alcohol now than at any time in the past 50 years, according to figures released recently by the Australian Bureau of Statistics. The ABS found there were 9.7 litres of pure alcohol available for consumption for every Australian aged 15 years and over in 2013-14, the equivalent of 2.1 standard drinks per person per day. How's that? That's good news, surely.
That is good news. And I think that it does show that people are being more selective with what they drink.
They are, aren't they? And yeah. I think this is where Alchemy is, your launch is timely, because you can have the best ideas, but if you don't plant it in a fertile environment, what you say may go unappreciated. But it fits within what you're trying to do, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And we definitely don't cover as many wines as a lot of other publications or as many drinks, but we look at them probably in a little bit more depth than a lot of other people.
And you don't give them points, which is, I know we've talked about this before, but gee, that's good, isn't it? Because as you've quite rightly said, well, I agree, and some people may not, but once you give a wine the points, the conversation goes out the window, doesn't it?
It's not a numbers game, you know. It's definitely so much more emotional, and the stories and the people's legacy that goes into this to diminish somebody's, you know, 3 years, often 4 years of winemaking before they've released a product to a number is fairly, you know, insubstantial.
It is, yes. Now, you'll be pleased to know that Australia drinks more white wine than red, 270 million litres of white wine in 2014, or 13-14 period rather, compared to 190 million litres of red. So we'll delve into that more in a future program. Now, Edition 5 takes us from the rich Terra Rossa soils of Coonawarra and the legendary Samuel Wynne to the mountains of southern Mexico, across to central California's emerging Paso Robles region, across to Turkey, thence to the Jura Valley in Portugal. Are you a bit dizzy here? We're travelling at a rate here. You traverse also the world of Domaine Chandon, world of bubblies, and you savour some benchmark Northern Rhone wines. Sip a classic Manhattan cocktail, discuss the role of natural hops from their synthetic counterparts, talk about the importance of context, which we alluded to earlier, when drinking, and talk to Jeff Kennett about whiskey and related relaxation, and discover a new espresso coffee recipe. There's so much to inform, entertain, amuse, stimulate, as you ponder in your latest Alchemy's 152 pages. Where do we start, Josh?
Good question. It really depends on what you feel like. In the morning, generally tend to start with the coffee sort of articles.
Yep.
But if you want to head straight in, then go into whiskey, I think, with what Jeff has to say.
Yes, we're almost at dinner time now.
Yeah.
So, look, I particularly enjoyed your In the Footsteps of Samuel Wynne article and how you weave that into the context of, you know, your family history. Because the Wynnes have exerted a substantial influence on Australian wine and food in more ways than one.
Sure.
And because they're now, the company, the Wynne name is now owned by a big conglomerate,
Treasury,
you tend to sometimes forget that. And it's I found that a fascinating article.
Cheers. Yeah, it was one of those ones where you didn't think there was going to be as much of a personal connection because it is owned by Treasury Wine Estates, which is a public company.
And you tend to write that off mentally, don't you?
You do, sometimes? Absolutely. And I just sort of discounted that for being, you know, a soulless, unindividual, lack of, you know, transparency through to the original vision. And as it happens, surely enough, my grandfather sort of pulled me up by the back of the shirt, grabbed me and said, hey, you know, I actually did know Samuel Wynne. And we had a chat about that. And that really elucidated some really, a new take on that traditional business for me.
Oh, that's good. Yes. And of course, you spoke to, who's the viticulturalist? I forget his name.
Alan Jenkins.
Alan Jenkins, yes. Yep. And that really came through, the
Yeah, well, it was really funny, actually, because there's a little anecdote from Alan Jenkins about a story with a possum.
Oh, and the orange tree. Yes, correct. Tell me. Yes,
well,
tell us.
Yeah. Well, essentially, we were sitting down to dinner, and Alan told me this story about this particular outhouse that he has, where he has his kayaks, mm-hmm. and a possum was living in there, and Alan relocated him about 20 k's down the road, only to find that 3 days later, the possum was back, and he was obviously tending to and maintaining Alan's orange tree for him, and just every so often checking on the crop. And that was the reason that Alan had originally relocated him. And so he then proceeded to take him a little further down the road, only to find him back a week later. And he just decided that the only solution was to plant another orange tree, one for him and one for the possum.
Awesome. Isn't that a lovely story?
It is lovely. And Alan couldn't understand when we were talking about it what interest I would have in recording this for the magazine, because that was over dinner. So I generally record my conversations to transcribe, but I didn't get that one because it was a casual environment. And the next day I came back and Alan was looking at me wondering why I would possibly want to know this for the magazine. Yep. But as it happens, I think it really does show, you know, when you're living in a wine region and you're tending to the vines, you have a lot of nature around you. And also it is a sustainability give and take. And I think that's a lovely part to show his interrelationship with the vines and his approach to viticulture as well.
And it shows your approach to the whole, to alchemy in general, because you're looking at drinks and wine in a broader context and looking at people who drink it and the circumstances and those little vignettes and stories. I mean, I think that's a very good illustration of the nuance that you're aiming to achieve, and I think you do it very well.
Thanks a lot. I think there are only so many ways that you can talk about spraying or biodynamic or organic viticulture without actually bringing in life's elements and nuances that people actually do talk about in real life conversationally. They are the ones that we're interested in.
Yes, in fact, I must introduce the possum to this pigeon's no longer living, but in the Second World War, pigeons were used, of course, for communication, and one was in a bomber that flew over Cologne. The bomber got shot down, everybody got written off. The pigeon made his way back, or her way back, to England and was awarded the equivalent of what's known as a VC.
Amazing.
Yes. So there we go. And I also like the, as I alluded to earlier, the article by Christian McCabe, A Moment's Whisper. That was on putting the context of drinking into context.
Yeah, Christian's a lovely gentleman, and he manages a restaurant and owns a restaurant called Town Mouse in Carlton.
Right.
And he approached us because he previously wrote a lot in New Zealand and he had a restaurant in New Zealand, and since moving to Australia, the writing part of his life had sort of fallen away, and we've engaged Christian to do quite a few articles for us, and he has a really down-to-earth perspective about drinking. He's really, he understands it in the context of dining, but not in the context of a leather-bound 400-page encyclopedic wine list, but just in terms of identifying his cuisine, his background, and also what's exciting and youthful about it. So his wine list speaks of him, but more importantly, his articles speak about what he prefers to do on his days off, which is quite interesting.
Well, we're going to take a short break, a little bit of music, and we'll be back shortly. Welcome back. I'm speaking to Josh Elias, the editor of the stylish Drinks Quarterly called Alchemy. What other issues touched you? I like the one about the round the world with Domaine Chandon, of course. That was very interesting because that illustrates the global perspective of wine, the homogenization of wine, yet on the opposite side of the coin, the individuality of they're trying to achieve. It's sort of there was a bit of tension there, isn't there, in that?
Absolutely. It was an intriguing article to prepare because we organised the wines directly, and with the magazine we source everything independently of the winery.
Good point.
So that allows us impartiality of tasting notes. And so we got a couple of wine writers, well, Philip Rich, who owns Prince Wines, yes. Sir, and Meg Brotman, Master of Wine, to taste with us in our usual panel. And their initial, Meg had previously worked at Domaine Chandon, but her tasting notes and Philip's were not as, enamored with the wines. They were very impartial and really cast their sword towards certain origins as being developing, and they still need a bit of time to find themselves in terms of sparkling wine origins. Yes. India's very new for making sparkling wine. But then in the long run, when we reflected on it, I managed to get some time with Susan Caudry, the estate director at Domaine Chandon.
Yes.
And she really put into context what the difficulties are and how they struggle in certain regions with new products.
Yes, yes.
And that allowed for a really interesting article where people can read the first spread and get the Domaine Chandon perspective, yes. read the second spread and get the taster's perspective and decide which route they want to go down in terms of forming their own opinion and ultimately trying the wines.
Mm. No, that was an excellent article. And what other article is stuck in your mind that you particularly enjoyed? We've covered such a diverse range.
Well, personally, visually, looking at the article in Mezcal in Mexico, Mexican food's so hot right now and has been so hot for the last 9 months. You know, I'm very loath to touch anything that's hot right now because you don't know where it's going to be in 6 months' time, and we try and produce a very timeless publication.
Yes.
But in terms of when we got that article, originally it was going to be a four-page article.
Yep.
And it ended up being 10 pages on the back of some beautiful, earthy imagery that showed top-down shots of basic piñas, or as they're called, which are essentially the hearts of maguey, which are the original crop that's used to make mezcal or tequila.
Tequila. Mm.
And so it was amazing just to see how earthy and how visceral it is, and it really is dusty and smoky, and everything that comes across in a really good mezcal comes across in the imagery. And so we let that drive our article, and I think that still sticks with me as a surprise that was like, well, 4 pages? No, 10 pages. It's worth something a little bit more.
And that, of course, that's where that's the art of editing, isn't it? Because you never quite know what the beast you've got hold of. You might have from the concept the idea, and that might turn out to be a page. It might turn out to be 10 pages. You really don't. That's the excitement and the stimulation for you, I suppose, and your team.
Absolutely, and it's not distinct. I think, you know, historically we were chatting in the past, Michael, about your role with Epicurean and, you know, the power of the graphic design in that particular publication. Some of the illustrations and artwork was amazing and allowed a new perspective on, at the time, quite groundbreaking editorial, you know, a take on the Australian beverage industry. And I think that we're gifted by the virtue of our photography and James, who's a business owner, to be able to rely on what he does. But sometimes, you know, you can set out upon an article, but until you get it all back and you see it together with the imagery, that will lead you where you go.
Yes, yes. Oh, well put, well put. And, of course, you spoke to Jeff Kennett. Now, the ubiquitous, I got a bit of a surprise to see Jeff because as much as I love Jeff, Jeff suffers from a bit of being a former politician and being Jeff, overexposure. And I thought, I opened my alchemy and here's Jeff. But it was an interesting perspective, wasn't it? I saw another side to him, and this is what you're, I suppose, aiming to achieve, aren't you?
Yeah, well, another sort of behind-the-scenes anecdote was that before we showed up for the interview with Jeff, I had just watched Andrew Denton's interview where Jeff had torn Andrew a new one in terms of the way that he was speaking to him. And it was partially and mostly Denton's fault in the terms of the line of interview that he took.
Andrew could be a bit patronising.
Absolutely. And he sort of wanted another agenda other than what Jeff had brought to the table prior to the interview. And I was sort of a little bit hesitant as to how this interview was going to end up. But like all things and whatever conversation guides the day, Jeff was in a mood to chat about whiskey. And that was a lovely, he had no shortage of, glowing praise for his collection, but also just his enjoyment and the product as indicative of places, whether it's Tassie, whether it's Scotland, whether it's Ireland.
Yes, because when you're talking whiskey now, there's some brilliant whiskey coming out of Tassie, and there's some in New South Wales, and it's a whole new take on whiskey, isn't it, I suppose?
The purity of the water in Australia, yes, in certain parts, the natural products that we have, and also just the time that we allow to go into the production of it, because patience with everything is key, especially in the production of any high-quality beverage or premium beverage. And we are really starting to see the rewards now in the Australian industry with the international awards for things like Sullivan's Cove and Lark.
Yes, Lark. And of course, that you do cover a wide gamut. You've had an article in an early edition, I think it was edition 2, I think, on milk. And you also had one, speaking of pure water, on the Tasmanian Cape Grim, didn't you? So you're not... You paint on a broad canvas, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that all of these beverages are important to all of us on a daily basis. To pretend that wine's the only thing we drink, I think, is a little divorced from our usual day. And we want to definitely indulge the nuances, because all of these products are made with care and with love and with a vision for, you know, their context within your life and meaningfulness. So we want to convey each element of all the drinks, not just one element of one drink.
And of course, it's a team there. There's James doing the photography. There's Nick Carey doing the design, because the design is critically important. And who looks after your contributors?
Raul Moreno-Yagüe is a
yes.
Yeah, he's a part of the business. There are four of us.
Raul.
There.
No.
Yeah. He's our you would say flying winemaker, because he does actually make wine as well.
Yes.
But he's our Spanish import. He's almost a matador, but he really brings contributors. He's very, very good at networking internationally, and that just helps with the breadth of coverage that we have in the publication.
Because I think I'm being very nice to you this evening, Josh,
but I can't help it.
But I'll pay for this one day. You know? But I think that's very important, because what I find refreshing about Alchemy is that you do have that international perspective. I think Australia's grown up a bit now to, you know, let's forget about the jingoism and we're from Australia and everything in Australia is best. You try, and it's not an easy thing to adopt an international perspective. And I get some feedback from friends that have read Alchemy from London, Europe, and New York, all over the place. And I think that enriches the perspective, because you're taking it out of Australia, but you have an Australian accent or flavour. Would that be true?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And I think, you know, like a country music singer from Australia who puts an American accent on, it doesn't quite fit unless you just let it subtly come through. And you can't help but let your bias and your original influences come out if you just write genuinely and from your heart. And I think that's true with the photography and the design as well.
Mm. And it melds together, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, that's
Yeah, and it is a process of just letting it sort of slot together. And if we feel that there's something that's kind of a bit jarring, we'll push that back and let it sort of take its time to resolve itself before we publish it, because we are quarterly. So we want to make sure that everything that goes in there stands the test of time.
Yes, of course. Now, some general questions, if I may. The relationship between money, taste and wine is complex, especially when it comes to price. And price is invariably seen as a proxy for quality. But as we know, quality doesn't always rise with price. At what price point does a bottle of wine start becoming too expensive for you, Josh?
For me, it starts becoming expensive indicative of its style. So,
yes.
If, for example, I will have a greater threshold for something like Burgundy and Bordeaux acceptedness for what I will pay for as relative to a light aromatic white from Italy.
Yes.
But to be honest, when I see a wine retail price above $75 to $80, it would want to be very, very convincing for me to go there.
Yes, yes. And do you think wine has become, this is interesting, and I think I alluded to it earlier, on one hand, it's become more democratic, and yet on the other hand, aristocratic at the same time, isn't it? It's that tension, that continuing tension that I suppose enlivens the environment, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and certainly never before in Australia has it been so good to drink wine made in Australia. But as that happens, we're getting more interesting designs, democratic labelling, so people talking about wine as juice, as grape squished, as, you know, rather than, you know, fine, lovely, aromatic, you know, complex, layered. We talk about it in terms of you know, drink it, get it in you sort of style.
Yep.
And that's something that, you know, people will pay $40, $50 for bottles like that. And yes. It's really becoming quite democratized.
Yes, and the ability to pay, of course, and the willingness to pay are two very different things. And I'm quoting Mike Vieseth here, but you have wine plus money equals no taste in the case of some celebrity wines. It's long been known that the easiest way to make a small fortune in the wine business is to start with a large one. And then you have taste plus money and no wine. Now, the only tourist, and Mike, this isn't my thinking, this is Mike Vieseth's thinking, but I agree with him. The only tourists drink wine in Paris today, because a lot of the French are no longer drinking. That's not their standard drink anymore, is it?
No, often these days it's things like gin and tonic, whiskey on the rocks. Bourbon is a huge growing category.
Craft beers,
absolutely.
Ciders, spirits are coming into their own.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. And I find it's really fun hunting down, and I suppose people who do it in the stock market, they say, well, always look for stocks that are undervalued and buy at the right time. It's the same thing with wine. The pleasure of, there's a wine store near here, I can't mention it, but I go in there and hunt for bargains. I find it's obsessive compulsive behaviour. And when I do find one, I get a thrill. And then the next thing, you want to share it. Do you find the same sort of thing?
Absolutely. And for anybody who has ever been intimidated by the wine industry, the only thing they need to know is that you never educate yourself with a view to hitting universal equals, because then you pay the universally equal price point.
Exactly.
You educate yourself with a view to your own palate, which allows you to find your own bargains. And it's absolutely thrilling to be that undiscovered wine, to find it and to say, well, this is something that I'm going to be buying six of, and if nobody else finds out about it, no problem.
Well, I had that case. I've got a passion for sparkling reds, which were a bit of a closet drink. No longer, they've come out of the closet, but I discovered one made by Andrew Buller, which was a composition of three Shiraz vintages dating back to the early 70s. I think one was 72 and the other was 86 and the other was 91 or something. Just lingering on a shelf there, sealed in cork, I jumped on it and served it, and it was fantastic. So that's the sort of experience. Now, whether you like sparkling red or it's neither here nor there, whatever turns you on, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and I think sparkling red's one of those ones that's going to come full circle, because sparkling wine is the quickest growing category for all wines. So
yes, I agree with you there. Well, Josh, thank you very much for joining us today and just giving us a glimpse into Edition 5 of Alchemy. And for those that haven't heard of it, get online and subscribe. That's my suggestion, because it's not a magazine, and there are some good magazines. This is a quarterly. It's nice and thick and chunky. It's stylish. Treat it as a book. Delve back into it like you do a good wine, and you'll make the most of it. Josh, thank you very much for your time today, and look forward to talking to you when Edition 6 hits the stands.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Now, my research material was sourced from my home library, and where else? Alchemy. This has been another Heard It Through the Grapevine on Vision Australia Radio, on stations all around Australia. Pardon me. Via the Community Radio Network, it's heard. And, it's cheers from me, and please drink moderately.
Heard It Through the Grapevine is a production of Vision Australia Radio. Sound information.